Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. Our subject today is curating local history. Every town and region has its own history. Sometimes that history is gathered together and presented in a museum. Sometimes people work with it in other ways. My three guests today all work with local history. And while their approaches are different, they all come to their subjects with the understanding that it's something worth preserving and understanding. Barb Oeschleker-Garvey is Assistant Director of the Museum of the Grand Prairie in Mahomet. Barb, just starting out, could you outline the scope of your museum's exhibit?
Well, our museum incorporates now, since we changed our name from the Early American Museum to the Museum of the Grand Prairie, it now incorporates not only cultural history of Champaign County and East Central Illinois, but also the natural history of Champaign County and East Central Illinois.
And Professor Timothy Kane is co-director of the Ethnography of the University Initiative here at the University of Illinois. And Tim, how about a quick summary in layman's terms of your work?
Sure. EUI is a cross-campus and interinstitutional project that fosters course-based undergraduate research about the university. So we have students who are trained in historical and ethnographic methods that turn their lenses onto, in our case, the University of Illinois. And then we archive that work in a digital repository.
And Kevin Hamilton is an associate professor of new media at the U of I, and he's created a comic book. I have a copy here, A Place in Time, Two Paths to a Television Broadcast, that uses as its starting point a national TV broadcast that originated at the University of Illinois in the late 1960s. And if you were paying attention, you would have seen it then on WILL-TV. And Professor Hamilton, what was that broadcast about?
So that broadcast was a sort of town hall style conversation about campus unrest. The producers of the program noticed that there was a sort of underlying theme going on across campuses in fall of 67, and they decided to bring together some student leaders and campus administrators to have a conversation about the future of the university.
We will pick up that thread of discussion in a moment after, and I invite you to bring your own questions and comments about collecting local history. Are you involved in historical preservation? Why is it important to you? You can call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu or seek us out on Facebook or Twitter. You can find us on either site at Focus580. Kevin, let me get back to your project. Is this something that you were looking for, or is this something that you stumbled across?
Very much something I stumbled across. I was working on a different project. I was looking into the history of a particular research lab that was on this campus for many years and found the transcript of this broadcast in the archives. And that really piqued my interest about this moment when the whole nation had a chance to watch a conversation happening here that started off being about the national conversation but ended up very much about a local conversation.
You found a transcript, and just reading the transcript, I take it, must have been interesting to you. How did you find the a tape or film of the broadcast itself?
That took some doing. The broadcast originated from an entity that's not around anymore, and the tapes from that entity, the Public Broadcasting Laboratory, went through a lot of different hands, as archival materials will do, and I just was very persistent. I called some people and emailed some people who said there's no way we can find that anymore. Eventually, the National Archives said that they did have some tapes of this, and they were on a format that was probably not long for this world, but they digitized one of these tapes for me so I could have a look at it.
We were talking about this before we went on the air, and I'm old enough and enough of a public broadcasting geek to remember not this particular program, not this particular episode, but I do remember the program, the Public Broadcast Laboratory, which was considered at the time an important but maybe not quite entirely successful transitional programming as what we used to call educational TV became public TV. Mm-hmm. And it aired at a time when there were a lot fewer public TV stations around, I would guess, in Illinois, Chicago, Urbana-Carbondale, St. Louis would have been it back then. So a lot of people didn't have the chance to see it at all. But I guess some people did.
It appears so. There's coverage of it in national newspapers that I discovered, and reviews of this particular broadcast in both local and national news outlets.
This was a discussion which became quite heated as people were talking about. Essentially, they were talking about priorities, and the priorities were obviously very different between people at the university administration, students at the university, both left and right, and the Black community in Champaign-Urbana. And I was particularly noticing, and you use screenshots from the video, of a young John Lee Johnson. John Lee Johnson, the local civil rights advocate who died just a few years ago. He was served two terms on the Champaign City Council. There's a honorary street named after a stretch of a street in North Champaign, and it's North Champaign issues that he keeps up keeps on bringing to the fore. People watching nationally might have been a little confused about what the point was he was trying to make there.
As were the people that were present, and that's one of the reasons that I was so piqued by this transcript, was seeing how John Lee Johnson and the other students who were there really pushing for the relevance of the local justice issues to the national and international conversation about the war in Vietnam just kept pushing. There's always a connection between these things. And that conversation really resonated with me today. I think many of what they're debating there could still be very much discussed as part of our own moment.
And this was a panel. There were a mix of people of national stature, people who were from out of town, and people who were right there in the community. So there really was a clash of priorities going on there.
And a connection of priorities as well. Yes, presidents from schools like Antioch College and San Francisco State University were flown in, as well as student leaders from early Students for Democratic Society and a couple other organizations. And it was a very interesting way in which, in fact, you can't really see where the two sides are very clearly in this moment, because what John Lee Johnson and the other students of color there really pushed successfully and rightfully was to even push those students who came in ready to push back against the administrators to also consider their own actions and their own situation.
I'm looking at just one short exchange here, and it gives an idea of how heated the language was. I'm sure John Lee Johnson was not talking this way once he got on the Champaign City Council, but he asks a question at the panel. Are white students ready to do violence on behalf of the Black man? Which I understood to mean is, are you ready to fight on our side for our interests? And the answer comes from Mike Rossman, who's from out of town. He's a leader in the free speech movement at the time. And he says, sure, look at Oakland, which by means he means Oakland, California, and not Oakland, Illinois, and Coles County. And John Lee Johnson answers, I'm not talking about Oakland. I'm talking about North Champaign.
Yes, and he has another good quote there that I don't put in the comic where he says, yeah, but my people aren't free in Oakland either. And really, really pointed the conversation in a really great way to just keep bringing it back to the local issues.
I do also want to bring attention to what I think is really a graphic novel moment, since we're not talking about drawings here. I don't know about the exact use of the phrase comic book, but John Lee Johnson does answer one of the more conservative white students as saying, well, racists like you don't know nothing about whites or blacks. And then another college student who is trying to be helpful says, the system keeps us all down. It tells me that I have to wear shoes all the time. And you just make the choice of, well, let's say the look on John Lee Johnson's face that you capture to the next screenshot, I think, is priceless.
And this is part of local history, is how you can make it come alive, right? I sadly did not meet John Lee Johnson before he passed. I was probably overlapped with him about 4 years. I moved here in 2002. And this is one of these moments where here I was deep in the university archives learning about this figure that a lot of people in Champaign know about every day. But that's the way history works, right? Not all of us are told the same histories.
Is participating in the test of the Illinois Emergency Alert System. This system was developed to provide information to the public during emergencies. This was a test.
With the Museum of the Grand Prairie in Mahomet. You can call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Post your questions and comments on Facebook or Twitter, and we're on both sites at Focus 580. I want to get back to the comic book for in later on in the broadcast. Tim, I wanted to ask you about your project, and what is it exactly that you're trying to preserve here that hasn't been preserved before?
Well, a big piece of it is we're trying to preserve students' works. In a typical class, students do very good research projects, and then at the end of the semester, turn it in, hopefully get feedback from their faculty member, and the paper goes away. It's in a way lost. It doesn't enter into a scholarly conversation.
Now, let's make sure we're not talking about faculty members' own research. We're talking about research that students, are these grad students or undergrads?
Some of them are graduate students, but most of them are undergraduates, from first-year students in their first class to seniors.
But this is actually looking for new knowledge under what's considered properly rigorous conditions, that knowledge would be considered dependable?
Yes. Some students do amazing work. As undergraduates from their first moments on campus, they are mentored in research methods in their coursework and produce new knowledge that is sometimes, as I said, lost. But through our project, we've created the infrastructures to help keep that knowledge available. And then in future courses that tackle the same questions, students go back and look at, well, the student last year or 2 years ago in this class did this project and came to these understandings. I'm going to build on that and use that as I would a journal article or other research.
So we're looking at student research projects. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming in the course of things here and at other schools, otherwise maybe some of these projects would be considered interesting enough and a student or their teacher might be ambitious enough to see that it gets published if it reaches that level. Does that happen sometimes?
It does. For the past 20 years or so, maybe 30 years, has been a big push in higher education for undergraduate research. And part of then what's come out of that are journals of undergraduate research. But this is a different type of a project in which we have maybe 1,300 or so research projects that students have done available through the Internet and the IDEALS archive here on campus. Those projects, the best of them, include not just a final product, a paper that you might see in a journal, but sort of the process documents leading up to it, the student's original idea, revised research questions, their plan for gathering data that then evolves in some way. So in the most rigorous projects, we see sort of a whole research process playing out and some new knowledge at the end.
Is there, you said this is being preserved online?
Yes, in the university's IDEALS database, we have our own collection there. It is the largest collection in IDEALS. We're usually the most often downloaded collection. We've had about 280,000 separate downloads of student projects or pieces of those projects over the past 5 or 6 years.
Okay, so this is not a new project. Well, it's relatively new, but it's been going on for a while.
Yeah, we're about a decade old.
Is there a web address that people can?
Sure, I believe it's eui.illinois.edu.
eui.illinois. I'm typing it in now. That's right. And
I have a bookmark.
Ethnography of the University Initiative. And I guess part of the challenge when you're doing something like this is how to put things in an order, always the case with knowledge, how to put things in an order that people can go find it. Is that still being worked on, or do you think you have it down to a science yet?
I think it will always be worked on. We've come a long way. We have a great team, and we work – actually, I really need to mention, we work very closely with partners across campus to allow this to happen, including in IDEALS. But we have our own – if you go to our website and you look under student projects, you can get to the archive of student projects where where they exist. They're categorized into 9 categories, things like student subcultures or diversity and equity, things along those lines, so that if you want to browse, you can do that. But they're also searchable. So if you go online on a search engine and search for something about the University of Illinois and a student's written a project on it, it can pop up on that search engine.
And I take it what you're recording is only the student research projects since the initiative began.
Right. We work closely with one of the pieces that becomes important in this type of work is getting human subjects approval through the university. So if our students are interviewing or observing or otherwise interacting with humans through the course of their research as subjects, they need to have the protections in place so that those subjects aren't mistreated. Just as I would, as a faculty member, need to have IRB approvals to do research. So we work very closely with IRB, with the university's bodies, to allow this work to be recorded. If we didn't have those protections and protocols in place, consent forms and everything that goes with it, then we wouldn't be allowed to make this research public. So one of the key pieces that we're doing is helping students understand the research project and how we protect human subjects within research that then allows them to take that knowledge that they're creating outside of the classroom. Otherwise, they wouldn't be allowed to.
Is this only the written record or whatever form that the data takes form that is preserved in this project? Are there any physical artifacts that survive from any of this research that are deemed worth preserving?
It's more than the written, because we have, especially in the past 2 to 3 years, gone more digitally with our work. Students have made documentaries. We have podcasts, oral histories. We work closely with Miranda Hensley in the library to help students present their work in multiple ways, including in poster formats. So if you go into our archives, you'll see a collection of PDFs of posters that students have created based on the work that they've done, both the historical and the modern day. But we're not collecting sort of physical archives, objects that aren't created through the research project.
No specimens or samples or whatever the case may be. Not yet, anyway. It does make me wonder, because the university's been around for a century and a half, and you started doing this about 5 or 6 years ago. What do you think you've missed?
Oh, I think we've missed a great deal. We're about actually a decade old, but some of the work is going back historically, working especially with the Student Life and Cultural Archives, which is a unique, one-of-a-kind facility on this campus. It's a wonderful resource that gathers material on student life here at the university primarily, but also more broadly. So our students are in those pieces, working with Ellen Swain and others, to really try to uncover student voices in diaries, in letters, and bring them back out. One of, I think, the nice things that the students are doing is trying to locate communities and cultures that might not at first appear in the larger sweeping narratives that we tell of ourselves, and see where those voices are in the archives. So members of LGBTQ communities, for example, how are their voices historically being recorded and not recorded? And going back in and looking at things such as that.
Okay. This is a Focus on WYLL. I'm Jim Meadows, and we're talking about curating local history with Professor Timothy Kane with the Ethnography of the University Initiative at the U of I, also Barb Olschlager-Garvey with the Museum of the Grand Prairie and Muhammad, and new media professor Kevin Hamilton, who's brought an old TV broadcast about campus and racial unrest at the U of I back to life in a comic book. And you can call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. Email us at will-talk@illinois.edu, or post your questions on Facebook or Twitter. We're on both sites at Focus580. Eric did so on Twitter to remind us that if you're looking for a resource of local history, you can check out the Champaign County Historical Archives at the Urbana Free Library, which he describes as 3,000 linear feet of materials and 25,000 books, all on local history. And is this a resource that any of you have had reason to use recently? You're nodding your head right over there, Kevin.
Absolutely. I was back and forth between those archives and the university archives in the research for this comic book. I discovered the original transcript of the broadcast in the university archives, but then started asking, well, what are the stories around this? How can I situate this broadcast in a longer narrative of our own town? So I spent a lot of time over there, and they're very important to my project.
Was this a big deal at the time in Champaign-Urbana, this national broadcast? Did the local papers note it? Did people pay attention?
They did. There was some local news coverage in the newspapers in anticipation of the broadcast, some small pieces, and then some slightly longer pieces after the fact. I would say the news coverage tended to focus more on the students of color who walked out, and sort of representing the broadcast more from that angle as a newsworthy story.
Mm-hmm.
The drama.
Yes.
Barb, with your work at the Museum of the Grand Prairie, does that archive over at the Urbana Free Library, is that something?
Yes. We frequently collaborate with the Champaign County Historical Archive. And, in fact, one of our major projects was acquiring an Institute of Museum and Library Services grant to put an exhibit in the Champaign County Courthouse, and we collaborated with the Historical Archives on that project. But I would be lost without Anka Voss and her staff. It's just an amazing resource for the community, for amateur historians, for professional historians, for genealogists. It's just an amazing thing that the county supports. We're really use it a lot, but we present things in a different way. They give access to the material, and we try to tell the story in a more graphic and interactive way. And I think, but we're like institutions.
I want to get back to you in that in a moment. But I do need to acknowledge, as we've been speaking, we have an email in from Anka Voss, and so let's give a shout out, especially to the website. Champaign County Historical Archives, and where you can find it online at the Urbana Free Library's website. Go to urbanafreelibrary.org/local-history-genealogy/resources. And Anka Voss writes that the materials there range from databases which provide access to genealogical resources worldwide to unique collections that document local life from the 1850s to the present day. They note that their collection includes manuscripts and records, including newspapers, books and journals, maps, oral histories, including several of John Lee Johnson, which you can listen to on our website streaming audio, and thousands of images, including print negative archives of the News Gazette dating back to 1970. So that's just for starters. Going back to the Museum of the Grand Prairie, and a museum is different from a library. You're trying to really make a presentation to people.
Right.
What do you look at? I mean, I don't know how you design an exhibit and what materials you look at to work with.
I don't know how you design an exhibit either. That's a joke. What one has to do is decide what will take people from where they are to a bigger idea. So oftentimes you have to focus on something that's familiar and broaden the knowledge of that or broaden the understanding of it. One hopes eventually that you give them some kind of aha experience, some kind of transcendent experience. Of course, that's the great hope.
Well, maybe we can use I'm thinking of one exhibit in particular that might be an example of something people are familiar with, and that's the one. You have an exhibit about Abraham Lincoln.
Right.
And people are familiar with Abraham Lincoln practiced law here in East Central Illinois.
Some people are.
Some people are. Do you find people who are surprised?
Oh, yes. Yes. Every day.
Okay.
In fact, we had a lecture this weekend, and there were still people who were attending the lecture who were surprised to find out that Lincoln practiced law here and for how long he practiced law here. And our exhibit called Champaign County's Lincoln is actually a partner exhibit with the one in the courthouse, so we don't talk about him as a lawyer, but as someone who knew the people who lived here, who end up being the people who created the community that we live in. We talk about just everyday sights and sounds of those eras, that era, so that people can get an idea of what it was like for Lincoln to travel, to stay in taverns, where he gave his speeches, the people he knew, and how people reacted to him after he was elected in this county. When they signed up to fight in the Civil War, a lot of it was out of loyalty to Lincoln. So,
And what do you use as far as materials, are there any artifacts? I would think that Abraham Lincoln actual artifacts must be pretty well picked over by now. Are there at least objects from that time period that you
use? Well, it's funny that everything that is in our Lincoln exhibit I'd say 95% are authentic artifacts from the era. I have a top hat. It's not a stovepipe hat in the entrance to the exhibit from the 1860s. Every school child says, look, it's Lincoln's hat. It doesn't really matter that it's not Lincoln's hat. They get an idea of what it looked like, what you know, the size of a hat of that era, and then half of them ask me, is it true that he carried his papers in his hat?
Is that true?
He did, as a matter of fact, yeah. Oftentimes, especially when it was raining. Keep it from...
That's the one dry spot he could assure. The time, it's about 32 past the hour. And I'm Jim Meadows, and my guests today are Kevin Hamilton, Timothy Kane, and Barb Oslager-Garvey. They're all involved in different ways in curating local history. We'll talk some more after a short break. This is Focus. This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. We're talking about the care and feeding of local history with people who are working with that history, preserving it and bringing it to new audiences. Barb Oslager-Garvey is Assistant Director of the Museum of the Grand Prairie in Mahomet. Professor Timothy Kane is Co-Director of the Ethnography of the University Initiative at the University of Illinois. And Kevin Hamilton is an Associate Professor of New Media. And you can find out about his work at his website, complexfields.com. oneword.org. That's complexfields.org. Call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can also email us at wyll-talk@illinois.edu or share your thoughts on Facebook or Twitter. Find us on either at Focus 580. The phone number is again 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. We have a phone call now, and let me get to that. Dave from Champaign. Dave Monk, is it?
Yes.
Good morning. You're on the air.
Okay. I want to say that some of the people involved in your research and the like are very broad in their understanding. In the Nixon era, when Nixon gave the community development money, John Lee Johnson was on the city council and very supportive of prairie restoration and things like that, that at the outset had nothing to do with the North End or controversial issues. But then we did tie that into Comprehensive Employment Training Act and murals, Black History mural in the North End. And so just... with regard to John Lee Johnson, I think I would like to you to realize that he had a breadth to him that was quite commendable.
Thank you, Dave. And I guess he really was a big part of the community during that period. Controversial to some people, but still a big part.
Yes, yes. And thank you.
Thank you, Dave. And that's is something that your comic book, bringing back that TV presentation. I never had a chance to meet a young John Lee Johnson, but he must have been pretty imposing in a lot of ways. And I'm wondering, Kevin, why did you make the decision? What led to, you know, you could have presented this material in a lot of different ways. You could have edited it into a little TV show and put it on a DVD or something like that. But you chose a comic book. Why is that?
There's a couple of reasons. One very practical and one more about questions of media. The practical problem at the moment is that the rights to this particular footage are pretty contested. And so it's a little hard to discover who can actually even view this piece. They made a copy of the broadcast for me to view with a lot of stipulations about not showing it to anyone at this point.
I'm wondering, so the Public Broadcast Laboratory, I'm trying to remember... who was the lead producer on that program in the late 1960s?
Well, the key question here in terms of the archives becomes who actually owns the rights to the footage, and that's WNET in New York. And so they're sort of standing between us and a rebroadcast of this video at the moment.
But okay. Did you try contacting them?
I did, and they gave me very firm no answers about this. So we'll see. I really turned to the print medium as a way of dealing with that question. I still wanted to get this history back out there in some way, short of publishing the whole transcript, which is quite a long thing to read. But there's something about the physical medium of a book that can be passed from person to person and can be discovered on a table somewhere or left on a bench that I think is important to the ways we tell our stories.
And you financed this in part with a grant from the city of Urbana, an arts grant.
Yes.
Did that pay for everything, or where else did you go to finance this project?
Oh, I was able to pay for the printing at least with that grant.
And how are you distributing it now? Where can people find this publication?
The book's available for free at a number of locations around town. They include the Douglas branch of the Champaign County Library, in the archives up there in the Urbana Free Library and the Champaign County Historical Archives, and the Independent Media Center has them as well, and then the high schools at Uni High and Urbana High School.
Okay, so that the two high schools in Urbana, the Douglas branch of the Champaign Public Library, the Urbana Free Library, yes. If you know where to go, I take it. Mm-hmm. Where particularly would you go in the Urbana Free Library to find it?
Well, I specifically wanted it to be in the archives so people could walk upstairs to the second floor back to the Champaign County Historical Archives, which are behind some doors that maybe not everyone opens, but which I wanted to invite people to step into to pick up a copy and see what's available for them there.
Okay. How many did you print?
There's 2,000.
Do you have any idea how many have gotten into the circulation yet?
Oh, there's probably about 700 or 800.
Are you getting any feedback on this?
I've definitely heard from some people pretty broadly, geographically. Some folks have heard about it and emailed me about it. My most exciting contacts so far have been with two individuals who were present for that broadcast who have contacted me as a result of this. So just having watched these folks on 45-year-old television and then having email exchanges with them is pretty great.
Okay. And Is there a next step with this? What would you like this to turn into, or have you thought of doing other projects this way?
The next step for this particular project would be I would love to find a coalition of organizations to find a way to rebroadcast this footage. I think the actual original television event happened in the South Lounge of the Illini Union, and in my best world, we could do a rebroadcast working with WILL perhaps, of that original broadcast, followed by a live discussion comparing the past moment to the present. I think it could be a really interesting idea.
Well, I'd love to throw that out there. And apparently the only copy, you went to the National Archives. Is that part of the Library of Congress?
They're separate institutions, yes.
Okay, because when I was searching online, the only place that seemed to have, that had been given a complete run of the public broadcast library mm-hmm. was Public Broadcast Lab was the Library of Congress. Apparently, the broadcast museums didn't have a complete set. There is one documentary from this TV series on YouTube, if you would like to go back in time for that. But it's not it's not this, unfortunately. It's interesting questions about presentation, and I'm wondering for the museum, for the Museum of the Grand Prairie, there must be things that you think about is how you're going to make it work. How you going to make it work for different age levels, for people who are learning for the first time that Abraham Lincoln, for instance, was here in East Central Illinois, and people who have, been through that before and are looking for something new.
Well, I think you start out by engaging people with interesting things. For example, in the Lincoln exhibit, we have a buggy that one can sit in and watch a video where you can actually get seasick watching the video behind the horse, and you think about hours and hours of doing that, then you have some visceral understanding of Lincoln's world. Or I just love the story about people who contacted you, because I had the opportunity to talk to Lincoln had his picture taken in Urbana. One of the many portraits of him was taken in Urbana. And it was taken by a photographer whose name was Samuel Altshuler. And I was just doodling around on the internet and found his picture, his portrait. Altshuler's portrait on a Jewish and American historian's website. And I actually made contact with Altshuler's granddaughter, who told me a story about how she grew up in New Jersey, but she moved to Florida as a child, and she took the picture of Lincoln to school one day for show and tell. And this was in the 50s, she was told to sit down because we didn't celebrate him here. And
where was this again?
This was in Florida.
Florida, okay.
Yeah. But it brought home to me the national connection to Lincoln and how it still goes on, you know. And I can't tell that whole story from that camera. We have a replica camera in the exhibit, and people can look through it and see the image upside down. We had to take the plate out because it could break. But I could tell Samuel Altshuler's story and the story of a Jewish family and the story of oppression that still goes on, you know, and the happy end to the story personally is that Altshuler's granddaughter now goes around Florida and gives talks about her grandfather's association with Abraham Lincoln. But, you know, that's 40, 50 years after the fact.
Well, it's fascinating that you can find these little pieces of history going off from just this one exhibit
right. On
what seems to be a limited topic, and then
right. It
goes all over the place.
Right.
This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and there's still time for your questions about curating local history for our guests, Kevin Hamilton, Timothy Kane, and Barb Oschlager-Garvey. Call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Phone number again, 333-WILL, or toll free at 800-222-WILL. And Timothy Kane, I wanted to get back to the ethnography of the university initiative. Do you know people, you talked about what sounds like a really high number of people accessing your website to look at these projects, taking off anybody who's just any former students who are just remembering bygone days of their old research. Who else is looking at this at this work, and how do you think they're using it?
That's a good question. We don't know fully, but we do get somewhat random seeming inquiries from people who've come across us online. We've gotten several from reporters who are very interested in some aspect of a student project because they're preparing a story or a news report on a related topic. And so they've reached out to us and said, well, we'd like to get in touch with so-and-so who wrote this piece on that's archived in your website. And sometimes we're able to connect them. Sometimes it's very difficult. Students own the copyright to their materials. It's part of the process that we build in so that they learn about publishing, about audience, and a number of those pieces. And some of them have chosen to publish their pieces anonymously. So we've had reporters reach out to us and say, you know, I'd like to speak with the author of this piece. Can you put me in contact? And, you know, unfortunately, there are times when we cannot. We've actually once or twice had people reach out to question of the findings that a student has come to because they have implicated a distant relative, for mm-hmm. example. And they've said, well, I don't think you got my relative story correct, and wanted to talk with the student that way or otherwise intercede in a certain way.
Can you give them contact information to the students involved?
If we have it, and we don't always have the students' information, they can publish completely anonymously, and so that we don't know the authors of some of these works, but we do know it was in a class that was taught by such and such professor in such and such year. But as with other graduates of the institution, they might have been here 8 years ago and done this report in a class and gone on and have different names and otherwise are no longer affiliated. So we have at times, I think, been able to we don't give out the students' information, but have contacted students that we could find and said, this person is interested in speaking with you or is interested in your project, and make a connection that way. But it's not always an easy thing to do.
Are other universities doing projects like this while they're essentially collecting and recording student research and making it available to the public?
Not in this way, as far as we can tell. We've looked around, and when we've presented at national conferences or written pieces for scholarly journals, people have always come back and said, this is really somewhat unique. There are certainly other efforts to capture student voices, both through informal archives and then through sort of the undergraduate research initiatives more broadly. But we haven't seen anything like this. What is happening now, though, are that people are contacting us and coming to us and starting to affiliate from their own institutions. So at 6 or 8 other institutions across the country, and actually one in Canada, people have said, you know, you're doing something interesting there. We would like to do something similar. Can we, you know, build on your model, borrow your model, what have you? And we say yes. And when we have our faculty training sessions, we've had people fly in or come in from out of town just to come spend a couple days with us as we talk about doing this type of work and the infrastructure support that you need.
Do you have cooperation generally from the students, or maybe sometimes they see this a really overworked, harried student would think, oh, no, this is another thing I have to do about my research project?
I am sure there is some of that reaction. I think that, you know, all these projects are course-based, and so usually students know what they're getting into when they sign up for a course, or at least they find out that first week when they see the syllabus. One of the things that we've really learned is the importance of structure in the courses. So most of these courses are content rich. It might be about Muslims in America or about the Korean diaspora or what have you. And so they're content rich pieces that the students need to get as part of their learning, as part of their undergraduate education. And then we're adding in this research component. So from the very beginning, it has to be structured in so that students know, you know, I need a research question that relates to the larger themes of this course and this university, because it has to be tied to the university. I'm within, you know, by week 5, and I need to understand literature that's going to relate to it by week 8 or what have you. And it becomes even more complicated with some of the new media type courses where students are building podcasts. Our co-director, Nancy Abelman, who's one of the founders, has structured in so that some of her students could have podcasts as part of a final project. More than 20 discrete assignments that the students complete over the course of the semester just to come up with that podcast at the end based on student interviews that are recorded.
Well, at this point, I want to get to one of our callers. Eileen in Urbana has been waiting patiently. Eileen, good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. I have a couple of comments. One, don't forget, this weekend you can see student research projects at the engineering campus, at the Beckman Institute Fair, and at the Natural History Service. That's the first thing. Second thing is the Museum of the Grand Prairie. It's like a jewel of the prairie. And when they have events, they usually are very well attended. But those are mostly, I think, local people in the surrounding communities. And I have spoken with some university students from out of town who really have not gone there. And I would just suggest that the listeners who know some undergraduate or graduate students who are kind of invested in the campus, go there and just see the amazing artifacts that are there, plus the written materials and the special exhibits, because it is really, really a good museum. Plus, it's also a museum outside with the Buffalo Trace Prairie and some other things. So hats off to the Museum of the Grand Prairie.
Well, thank you very much, Eileen. I appreciate it a great deal. And we should also mention that the Homer Lake Interpretive Center is part of the Champaign County Forest Preserve District, too. And there's a nice, good exhibits there, as well as, of course, the outdoor exhibits. We're working also on trailside interpretive signage so that people can appreciate the entire environment of Champaign County.
How could I forget that? You are right. Wonderful resources for our community, and especially for people who are from out of town.
Right. That's right. I think you're right. There's a reach there that, because we're not in Champaign-Urbana.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
Eileen, thank you very much for that unsolicited testimonial.
I love it.
Okay. Take care. Thank you for calling.
Bye.
And you almost look a little embarrassed to be to have your museum praised that way.
Well, it's not my museum.
One of the themes I think that is underlying some of our discussion here is this question that we have sometimes about why should I know about history and who's taking care of that?
Mm-hmm.
Because oftentimes we have ascribed those tasks to the people who are writing the history books that are on the shelves, or the big museums with lots of funding, or people researching their own individual ancestry. And I think a lot of what's coming up here through even some of the callers is that knowing about what happened before you came along really can change the way you regard your everyday life. And these students moving through this initiative are really gaining new orientations and perspectives on things that otherwise seemed unchangeable. And the same for the work going on at the museum.
That raises a question. I was wondering,
as well as what you do.
Matter of fact, both of your projects raise questions. I'm wondering, do you see this initiative as playing a role as when historians look at the University of Illinois in the future, that they will also have this component with the research that students were doing there?
I think so, definitely. I think in two ways. One is some students are doing, you know, their own history projects that are then being recovered and being made accessible to others, including professional and other amateur historians who want to take advantage of them, build off them, cite them. Since these pieces are available online and they have stable URLs, they can be and should be cited when they're being used. But the other part of it is, since we're capturing the questions students are asking, the things students are interested in, the types of research that they're doing and the way they're thinking about it, we're creating the ability to later on go back and say, well, how did students ask questions about identity over this now 10-year period? But moving forward, hopefully, you know, we'll be around in 20 years and we can still do it. For some faculty members who've taught with us multiple times, they can actually go back into the archives and look at all the projects that their students have done over the course of 5 or 6 or 7 iterations of a single class, and then mine that to see larger themes of the student works and how it's changing, how it's evolving, and what students are thinking about their experiences here at the University of Illinois.
Wow. And Kevin, if I can ask you, in the case of A Place in Time and looking back on that old TV broadcast, what did that tell you that you didn't know before about the history, and why do you think that's important for people to know now?
You know, I certainly knew that there were tensions and discussions about the campus's role in local justice movements. But the thing that most stood out to me was that this particular conversation took place in front of a national audience. And local issues connect to global. They're enmeshed in ways that sometimes we tend to divide out. I'll read the local news now. I'll read the national news later. I don't have to think about how these things relate. But they're connected, and decisions we make locally do affect our participation as a nation and as a state in global issues. And that was really what struck me about this.
Yes.
And I think in an interesting way, our project does something that's almost in the reverse. We have a lot of courses that are looking at national or international issues, and then the students have to find a local way of studying that idea. So if you're looking at Korean diaspora, well, how are you going to study those issues here at the University of Illinois?
Mm-hmm.
And so they're making the connections from the global to the local in sort of the flip way that you're talking about.
I want to get a word in for Barb because we've really talked mostly about one exhibit at the Museum of the Grand Prairie.
Right.
But maybe you can tell people what's coming up next. Is there anything new coming up this year in 2013 at the museum?
Well, we're embarking on a renovation of all of our upstairs galleries that will incorporate natural history into the cultural history, and we have a special exhibit this year on a local architect, Joseph Royer, mm-hmm. who has been called Urbana's architect. Brian Adams wrote a book to that effect, and he's actually guest co-curating with the exhibit with me. That opened on Friday, and there's a lecture on St. Patrick's Day, 2 p.m., March 17th, on Royer. We have scores of programs, both cultural, natural history, and almost entirely local. I would just recommend going to our website or to the Forest Preserve's website. So that would be www.museumofthegrandprairie.org. Yes, a really long URL. Or www.ccfpd.org for all of our programs.
Well, at that point now we're out of time, but I wanted to say thank you to all of our guests for talking with us about curating local history. Barb Oshlager-Garvey of the Museum of the Grand Prairie, museumofthegrandprairie.org, open daily from 1 to 5. Kevin Hamilton, author of A Place in Time, Two Paths to a Television Broadcast, available at the Douglas Library branch in Champaign and the Urbana Free Library, among other places. And Timothy Kane of the Ethnography of the University Initiative. This is Focus on WILL.